This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm reading again from Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina, published in 2002. The subtitle is Visions of Hope and Survival. We are on Tern Island in the French Frigate Shoals, which is part of the Hawaiian Islands chain, which is one of the most remote places on Earth. I hope you've heard the first readings I've done from this terrific book. You can find them online at wdrt.org. They're all archived there. All my programs are archived. I'm going to be reading part of Chapter 1 and into Chapter 2. Albatross courtship is almost certainly the most intricate courtship of any non-human being. The reason is that there's a lot at stake. The pair bond and relationship must last years. The commitment implied is immense. Compared to other animals, an albatross does not get very many chances to breed, and each breeding attempt, each egg, is highly valuable and expensive. Albatrosses can lay only one egg in a season, and many cannot nest every year. Unless your mate invests extraordinary effort, your chick dies. If you're going to put your only egg in somebody else's basket and sit there for weeks waiting for them to return, you want confidence that they're committed. If you want them to come from thousands of miles away after weeks at sea and feed your chick, you want to know they're committed. If you're considering a marriage that may last several decades, you want to feel sure they're committed. So albatross courtship is highly complex. It involves both sexes very actively, rather than just a male doing most of the displaying. And they don't rush into anything. The mutual wooing may last months or years. Females want to be sure males will feel invested enough to return. Males want to be sure the chicks they invest in are their own. But consider this, all males, in a sense, care for young that are not their own, because all males incubate eggs produced by a female, not by them. This trivial truism has repercussions that wrap the ends of the earth. The great dilemma of being male is uncertainty of paternity. Result, much of male psychology is geared toward aggressiveness, designed ultimately to accumulate rank and territory necessary to attract mates, depose rivals, and ensure fertilization of females and creation of genetic heirs. This is true across species, order, class, and phylum. It's true among tropic birds, verifiable among vultures, beheld among beetles, done among dolphins. Perhaps this is the root of male insecurity and the deepest taproot of male aggression and violence the world over. But consider also, among these albatrosses, nesting in these densities, it's perhaps most surprising that most males do in fact incubate eggs of their own parentage in the right nest, in the right place. For that, of course, they can thank females. Females do have a choice, and they use it. Here's the dirty little secret of the many splendid monogamy of most kinds of birds that mate for life. Quite a few of them color outside the lines. In most species, females often try to get fertilized by males who are older and better established and hold higher status than their mates. Because a proven survivor is the best indication of the high-quality genes you want your child to inherit. These same patterns and tendencies function throughout the animal kingdom. Many birds, even some albatrosses, aren't really very different from many people in this regard. Thus, elaborate, prolonged dancing is, in a sense, the albatross's search for reassurance, their quest for a promise. At the beginning of courtship, females may respond aggressively. Is this male serious? But after displaying with the same male for some time, they allow closer proximity, mutual preening, and eventually, years later, mating. Lance Tickell, who studied albatrosses for half a century, has written, "Over several years, the number of different birds with which an individual communicates will steadily decline until it is perfecting the language of one partnership, distinguishable from all others." This synthesis of language unique to one pair is, through repetition synchronized in that pair. The paradox of these events is that once mutual language is so perfected that breeding can take place, much of it ceases to be used. Breeding pairs no longer employ the full vigor of their language because they recognize each other and continually reinforce their close relationship by contact and preening, unquote. With the development of intimate familiarity, the dancing ends. Between experienced breeders, mating is usually a quiet act carried out on the pair's territory with little or no preliminary display. Experienced pairs often breed together over many years until one dies. Divorce is unusual. Most albatross species display exceptional fidelity. Albatross pairs sometimes remain together for longer than 2 decades. And now into chapter 2, called Bonding. Even before the horizon began so slowly to lighten, Dave and Patty were already in the main room prepping the 10 high-tech tags Dave has brought. Patty asked me how I slept. I was awake a lot, enjoying the constant murmurs, purring, and chattering from the hundreds of noddies and the fairy terns nesting just outside the dorm windows, and from thousands of sooty terns who came in after sunset and overnighted on the runway. Now, rather than having singing birds as dawn's alarm clock, the island is the quietest it's been all night, because the sooties have already departed to search their fishing grounds. Still tired from yesterday's travel and the nocturne chorus, I could have used another hour's sleep, but being awake here is better. Sometimes a dream feels real. Here, reality feels like dreaming. Dave shows me one of the transmitters. It looks like a robotic mouse with a mouse-sized body and a long wire tail. A pricey little unit, $2,900, it communicates with satellites that zoom around Earth in under an hour. It's the biggest advance in seabird tracking in over 150 years. On December 30th, 1847, off the Chilean coast, Captain Hiram Luther of the whaler Chachalot shot an enormous albatross. Tied around its neck was a vial containing this message: 8 December, ship Euphrates. Edwards, 16 months out, 2,300 barrels of oil, 150 of it sperm. I've not seen a whale for 4 months. Latitude 43 degrees south, longitude 148 degrees 40
minutes.
Thick fog with rain. The bird had flown 3,394 miles in 22 days. For half century and a half, this fatal fix remained the best record of albatross flight over distance until the advent of satellite tracking in the 1990s. A transmitter weighs about an ounce, 1% or so of an albatross's body mass, a tenth of the weight of an albatross's egg, a 20th of the bird's usual weight fluctuations during breeding. Dave remarks, "The birds seem relatively comfortable. They don't try to take them off." I'm skipping ahead. And so the birds are fitted with satellite telemetry. They've banded Amelia and two other albatross. At 10 o'clock, we take a moment's rest on the porch. Amelia is dozing just a few feet away. Her transmitter is hidden by feathers, its antenna barely showing. A noddy lands on the porch rail near my arm. The weather has been unseasonably warm, abnormally hot, actually. The air unusually still. More typically, continuous winds blow here, but now the heat is intense, and the sitting birds are showing the strain. They are clearly uncomfortable under the pressing tropic sun. Many have raised the feathers on their backs like louvers, trying to radiate heat. Some albatrosses have recently deserted. Either the mate's dead or the heat has gotten to them. Dave doesn't want to put on any more transmitters or handle any more albatrosses until the weather changes. He asks Patty's opinion. Patty says in recently acquired English, "Well, because albatrosses lay only one egg, they don't breed every year. You have to try to make sure you don't cause more problems to any bird, so let's wait." While everyone goes inside to eat, I linger on the porch, savoring existence. Beyond the lagoon and reef, the ocean rolls placid and eternal, Pacific as ever, until it meets the reef. Right now, the swell on the north side of the island is piling a 10-foot surf. You can see but not feel the violence because the breakers exhaust their energy by pounding the resolutely resisting reef. Each rolling swell that has wrinkled the sea surface for thousands of miles unfurls itself here, becoming a breaker for a moment or two, taking everything that went before and turning it into something new, different, spectacular, and brief. Ah, yes, brief. As Virgil said, "Death plucks my ear and says, 'Live, I am coming.'" When sea levels were at a low point 17,000 years ago during the last ice age, high tide was 300 feet lower than it is today. Some of today's barely drowned shallows and barely emergent atolls like French frigate shoals would have been substantial islands. Now there's not much margin for error. In fact, if not for the magic of coral, many of the most bird-populated atolls would already have drowned. An atoll is a roughly circular island with a central lagoon dependent on the upward growth of corals to keep its head above water. Today, many of the northwestern Hawaiian islands are atolls. Some North Pacific atolls have been drilled to see how thick their coral cap is. It's thick, thousands of feet at certain atolls. Charles Darwin, an even greater genius than most people realize, was also first to correctly figure out the evolution of atolls. As magma rises from a hot spot or a plate boundary in Earth's mantle, a volcanic island forms. By the time formation ends, as when the island is conveyed away from the hot spot on a moving plate, the massive mountains have already begun eroding. Those Hawaiian islands that have moved west of the active volcanic zone have begun this process. Over 2 to 5 million years, while the mighty island begins subsiding, a ring of corals forms around the island. In 5 to 10 million more years, as the island continues sinking, the coral forms a fringing reef. By 10 to 30 million years, the island submerges just below the sea, leaving a ring of upwardly mobile growing coral reef and low islands around the perimeter and a shallow lagoon in the center. As long as their corals can grow fast enough to keep pace with island sinkage and sea level rise, these will be islands and atolls. The place where the water becomes too cool for coral reef's growth to keep pace with sinkage, about 29 degrees north latitude, is called the Darwin Point. In the Hawaiian chain, it is no coincidence the Kure Atoll, at the extreme end of the northwestern islands, is both the last emergent island and the world's northernmost atoll. This is the last place where coral growth can compensate for island subsidence. The sunken emperor seamounts are the drowned islands past this point, whose fossil corals, extinguished by too cool waters, still cap the submerged lands. This fate next awaits Kure too, on its inexorable journey north, and the sea will eventually reclaim each island as it trips over the Darwin Point. The albatrosses have a deep history, too. The earliest known fossil albatross is about 25 million years old. Albatross species similar to those now flying were coursing the seas 16 million years ago. Albatrosses and all the tube-nosed seabirds descended from a common ancestor. That ancestor's other descendants branched off to become different highly specialized families of aquatic birds. While one extreme line of seabird adaptation became the penguins, who entirely sacrificed flight for deep diving ability and turned their wings into fin-like flippers that can no longer be folded, the tube-nosed seabirds invested everything in the ability to fly as far as possible over the oceans of Earth. Though they range almost limitlessly in any direction, the vertical lives of tube-nosed birds are severely compressed, seldom rising more than about 50 feet from the surface. While they travel distances unimaginable to us Altitude never occurs to an albatross. It's as though by collapsing their world into just two dimensions, true flatlanders, they maximize the spread of distance. In the 18th century, the great biologist Carolus Linnaeus gave the tube-nosed seabird group its scientific name, Procellaria, from the Latin for storm or tempest. The group comprises roughly half of all seabirds, well over 100 species in several subgroupings. In size order, the storm petrels, the smallest, weigh under an ounce. Diving petrels, prions, larger petrels, and shearwaters, giant petrels, and albatrosses. The largest albatross is about 350 times the size of the smallest storm petrel. The easiest way to remember what distinguishes albatrosses is that while other tube-nosed birds' nostrils are fused atop the bill, albatrosses' nostrils lie separated alongside their bill, and among tube noses, only the giant petrels rival some albatrosses in size. Albatrosses are big. Today, albatrosses inhabit every open ocean except the North Atlantic. Fossils from eastern North America and Europe show that albatrosses lived even there 5 million years ago. Rare, vagrant albatrosses do occasionally turn up in the North Atlantic. Two black-browed albatrosses appeared annually in northern gannet colonies in the Faroes and in Shetland for 25 years. Yellow-nosed albatrosses are sighted from time to time off North America and Europe. But any Atlantic sighting north of the equator is extremely rare. Most bizarrely, a wandering albatross slipped through the Strait of Gibraltar, crashed onto the coast of Sicily, and was hit by a car and killed. On that sad note, I think I'm going to stop here and continue. I'm kind of addicted to this book. I'm happy to be out in the Pacific thinking about the vast ocean. I've been reading from Carl Safina's book, Eye of the Albatross, published in 2002. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.